Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Our next guest asks one of life's most profound and essential questions. Who am I? Really? We often assume self-knowledge comes naturally, that we understand our own personalities, motivations, and desires. But psychology and neuroscience tell a very different story. We may be strangers to ourselves more often than we realize.
For more than 20 years, University of Chicago professor Eric Oliver has taught a legendary course, The Intelligible Self, that students routinely describe as life-changing. In his new book, How to Know Yourself, The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are, Dr. Oliver blends scientific research with philosophy, storytelling, and practical insights to help us better understand the forces that shape identity and how we can uncover a deeper sense of who we truly are. Professor Oliver, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So your book asks one of the biggest human questions of all time. Who am I really? So what motivated you to explore the science behind self-knowledge? I mean, it's a big question.
Yeah, and for me, it started when I was in high school, and I had this great high school English teacher who wrote Know Thyself on the blackboard. And she said, here in these two words were distilled the collective wisdom of the ancient Greeks. And if we wanted to have a liberated and meaningful life, we needed to know ourselves. And I took her words to heart. I was having kind of a bumpy adolescence. And I thought, oh, if I could just figure this self out, then maybe the path ahead would be a lot smoother. And it took me about three decades of searching to realize that her advice actually had a few fundamental flaws. Like when the ancient Greeks actually wrote know thyself, in the extent that they said know thyself, they didn't really have a word that meant self as we know self. They really meant more like something like know thy place. And for most of human history, this was the case. Most of our ancestors lived in small tribes that were tightly bound by custom and tradition. You didn't really worry what your purpose in life was, how you would find love, what you should do for a career, because all that stuff was determined for you. And so you just had to know your place and play your role. And over the past couple of hundred years, especially in the West, that has come undone. And there's been some real positive benefits from that. We now have liberal democracy. We have these flourishing economies. We have all of this individual choice. But it's come at a real profound cost for us, which is, who am I? What is going to tell me who it is that I'm supposed to be? How do I find love? How do I find purpose and meaning in life? And so I spent about a couple of decades of my early 20s and 30s trying to figure this out and tried everything. I read deeply into philosophy. I studied psychology. I went on long meditation retreats. I hiked naked in the wilderness. I was all trying to take it all in and figure out maybe something is going to shed some light for me. And luckily for me, I got a job here at the University of Chicago, which I figured, like, if I was going to try to figure out myself, this would be an ideal place to look. And one great thing about teaching here is they let us design our own courses. So I put together this class that combined all my eclectic interests in Buddhism and neuroscience and philosophy. And my wife, Riley, suggested I name the class Stuff I'm Interested In. But I opted for the more respectable title of The Intelligible Self, and my students seemed to get a lot out of it. And so I kept offering it year after year. And in the course of doing this, I think I've came to a way of synthesizing all of these different modalities and traditions and wisdom streams and scientific knowledge. And I thought, okay, maybe here's an opportunity to do something useful. And I can put all these things together in something of a coherent framework, or at least a semi-coherent framework. Wrote the book, How to Know Yourself.
Well, I understand that the course is extremely popular with your students, so congratulations on that. But the concept of self, I mean, this feels deeply personal. And you could argue it's also something that we can study scientifically. How does science help us better understand identity and help us better understand self? Or I should say, the definition of self.
Right. And I think one of our challenges is that there are numerous philosophical discussions and debates about what the self is. There are hundreds of books out there that purport to help us help ourselves, but almost none of them actually have a clear definition of what the self is. And when I was trying to formulate one, I found, like, actually science can give us a pretty good clue of that. And science can tell us some things about ourselves that don't normally reside in our conscious awareness. And that's one thing that's great that science is really great at. It's about shedding light on things that we can't commonly observe or that exist outside the realm of our ordinary intuitions. One thing that science tells us about ourselves, for example, is that we're energy systems. Like everything else in the universe, we're comprised of energy. And in fact, if you look at yourself at the molecular atomic level, you'll find there's almost no matter there. Each of our atoms and molecules are just comprised of tiny, tiny little specks of matter. Mostly, they're just energy. This solid being that I assume myself to be is really an illusion of energy. And so once we begin to think about that, then we begin to think about ourselves in a very different way because, okay, if I'm an energy system, well, what is it that defines me? And the funny thing is, because we are living energy systems, we are doing something very, very unique in the universe. We are pushing back against entropy because this is really what defines life itself. It's an energy system that's organizing itself in the face of the great energy degradation of the universe, which is entropy. And so this is where, for me, the definition of the self begins, because the self are all those processes that allow this pushback against entropy. It's what keeps the flame of life alight. And it's been doing this on this planet for at least 3.7 billion years. And we're all traced and linked back to this original last common ancestor, and we're all part of this undergoing life force that's been happening. And everything that we know about ourselves, from our cellular structure to our neural architecture to our language, our customs, our rules, our identities, the stories we tell about ourselves, our own egoistic conceits, all of these things are parts of the way that this life force that's within us is negotiating with reality and pushing back against entropy.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation about yourself. How to Know Yourself is the name of the book written by our guest, Eric Oliver. And Eric, as you're talking, it's almost making it sound as though we are one grand collective self. But the very that runs up against the very definition of self, meaning that you are an individual. And so coming from this greater definition that you just gave us about, you know, we are here to push back against entropy, are there individual energetic vibrations, or what is it that determines our individuality? Because our individuality changes so much throughout our lives. I mean, we have our kindergarten self and our, you know, teenage self and our 20-something self, and, you know, which is all very different than my whatever age I am now self. You know?
To answer that question, I like to bring up one of the common misconceptions that we have about ourselves. If we think intuitively, I think of myself as a relatively stable, solid, singular individual. And that makes sense. I think of myself as a thing, really. And I, for a long time, part of my study of the self was I wanted to try to master this thing, because if I could master this thing, then I could potentially live better. But here is where, once again, our intuitions mislead us. We are not things. We are processes. There is nothing about our existence that is static. We are, from our molecular interchange of our bodies to our cellular metabolism to the electrical impulses that underlie our consciousness, it's all dynamic flow. And what's more, it's not just one single process. It's a myriad of processes. Now, to answer your question then, why do I feel so separate, or is there something very distinctive about me? And the answer is kind of yes and no. On the one hand, yes, you are having your own individual experience. I'm having my individual experience. We're not mind melding at that level. So yes, each of us is a distinct element of this life force kind of pushing back against entropy. And life itself is remarkable in that way. You know, life feeds on itself. It, you know, it combines and coagulates in all kinds of interesting ways. But what this also means is, think of it as something like we're all, like, to use a metaphor, like individual leaves on a grand tree. Sure, we have our own individual expression, but in some ways, we're all expressions of the same underlying life force. And I find this kind of a both spiritually profound idea and really comforting. Like when I'm walking in nature, I look around and I think, and I see trees, for example, and I say, well, I share several hundred genes with these creatures. we all trace back to a shared ancestor. In some ways, we're just different expressions of the same underlying life force that's been pushing back against entropy for several billion years. And that thought is both, on the one hand, can be incredibly uplifting and comforting. And, you know, that sense of isolation and loneliness I sometimes experience, I find it really ameliorates that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's a bit of a gut punch, because it doesn't mean that, it means kind of, I don't matter all that much in the grand scheme of things. And so that's kind of what knowing yourself is about, is coming to terms in some ways with the fact that you're not as important, at least as our ego processes tell us that we should be.
That makes a lot of sense. But when you talk about walking in nature and kind of pondering the trees and things like that, there are times that certainly we all feel a heightened sense of connection or connectedness to the world around us. Sometimes it's with people, sometimes it's walking in nature. And this is something that we strive for, ways to feel more connected. So then how do you teach your students in the Intelligible Self class at the University of Chicago, you know, what the first steps are to recognize something that makes us feel connected?
Yes. And that's, you know, I give them an assignment, for example, and I say, I want you to go out and spend an hour walking one way across the quad. Put down your phone and just do something in an unusual way to jar these habitual patterns of perception that you normally rely on to getting through the world, and see what unfolds for us. And I think this goes to the problem of consciousness. Most of the time, our consciousness is very compressed and constrained by some egoistic melodramas. You know, we have these ego processes that are in place to help us negotiate with the social world, and they tend to preoccupy us. They give us our identities. And I spend most of my time thinking either about, oh, those things I shouldn't have done in the past, or those things I hope to do in the future. And that really preoccupies a lot of my thinking, and it compresses me, and it seems to delimit my whole sphere of understanding. But of course, there's so much more to our sense of being than just those little micro dramas. And a big part of coming to terms, like when we're in nature, is letting go of that. And one of the things that I try to tell my students is that we actually have within us a latent effervescence. That sense of like goosebumps, the tingle that you get sometimes get, that's always coursing through us. This is typically too subtle for our ordinary minds to make access to. When you can access that sense of being where you feel yourself in a more radiant position, the dramas that typically compress us, the unproductive emotions that oftentimes lead us astray, it gives us an opportunity to move away from that and to begin to not have them dominate us so much, because these are typically the imbalances in our self processes. When we spend a lot of time feeling anxious or depressed or enraged, these are typically inefficient emotions for us. They're not really appropriate for the moment. And the more that we can begin to let go of them and recognize them for what they are and then let go of them, the more open we become to this more innate luminescence that's within us.
That's really kind of an interesting concept, because I think a lot of people talk about finding their true self. But from your research, is there really such a thing as a fixed, authentic self? Or are we constantly evolving our true self?
Well, that's what I said. I like this quote from Buckminster Fuller, who said, you know, I'm not a noun, I'm a verb. And, you know, it's like asking, is there a true river? You know, if we're processes here, there's never going to be one fixed state that we're in. And that's great news, because, you know, I know, for example, I carry around oftentimes a lot of feelings of, I'm not good enough, I'm a bad person. You know, I feel it goes back to this feeling of being fixed. And in some ways, being fixed, that means indelibly bad in some ways. And that's an illusion. Because there's the process. And what we can do in terms of beginning to know ourselves is beginning to identify these processes. And part of these processes exist at a cellular level. So a big part of beginning to know ourselves is, well, what makes our cells thrive? How can we live more healthy, in a more healthy way, at a cellular level? There's an animal level, which is, it goes back 500 million years ago when we had these early ancestors who became multicellular. And they started developing neurons and sense organs and mapping reality and making perceptions and predictions about what would happen next. Well, what is my animal brain doing? How do I live in a thriving way according to my animal nature? And then, of course, we humans are really distinctive because we have language. And language allows us to shape ourselves in new ways. We can concoct new identities. We can concoct new laws, new moral standards, new technologies. And then we have to begin to ask ourselves, okay, well, what are all these new inventions doing for us? For example, my cell phone is a big part of my self-process now. It's a big way I mediate with the world. Now, is this a helpful device for my self-processes, or is this a self-abnegating device? Is this something that's destructive? And so there's no one singular self here. As you can see, there are these different layers of processes that are happening. And what we need to be attentive to is where the imbalances exist amongst and within these various layers and processes, and how we might come to live in a more efficient, harmonious, and as I said earlier, maybe a more radiant way of being.
I am really glad you brought up technology, because here on Cool Science Radio, we just can't escape it. So I'm curious, the technology and social media is constantly bombarding us now. Do you think that the digital age makes it harder or maybe easier for people to truly know themselves? Does it get in the way? Is it helping us or is it hurting us?
And the answer is yes. Insofar as, I mean, on the one hand, I marvel at what the technology of the past 15 years provides me in terms of when I want to know things about subjects. The fact that we can have this conversation, even though we're in two different cities and it's going to be broadcast and we can share this information so widely, I mean, that's unprecedented. I remember when I first went to college, and I remember I was like walking around campus and thinking, oh my God, there's all this knowledge here, but it's locked away in these books. And I have to get through these professors to get to the knowledge, and they're going to show me what to do. And now that's all available to us. So we've seen this incredible democratization of knowledge. So that part's great. On the other hand, as you probably have discussed before, we are embedded within a system of companies that are trying to monopolize our attention. And monopolize our attention by hijacking our neural systems, particularly systems of dopamine, which are these surprise reward systems, you know, that make it so compelling. And how do they do that? You know, they show us cat videos, or they show us outrages in faraway places, or they stoke our indignation about, you know, fake conflicts. Or, you know, so you have this online conversation. And so I spend a lot of time asking my students, for example, I say, listen, when you are spending time on this phone, are you exercising a competency? Are you learning anything? Or are you just being sucked into this kind of attention economy that is designed to manipulate you? And so I think with any technology, there's always a double-edged sword. We can go back to the printing press, the double-edged sword. We could go back to the advent of agriculture. We could say for our species was a double-edged sword. All of these things have mixed implications for us. And I think it's important just to say that these are steps in our evolution of self-processes. Now, where they lead, I don't know. Maybe in 100 years, you know, humans will look back on us and say, how did they get anything done without that sort of dedicated brain to quantum cloud interface? And maybe that's how our self-processes will evolve. Or maybe we'll decide at some point to chuck all this technology and go back to living, you know, like the Amish. It's unclear.
When you have your students in your class, I'm sure that the questions that you ask them and the exercises you have for them to do, does it create that kind of higher vibration that you see?
I think so, because I see them opening up, and I try to give them a lot of exercises where we're not just reading, say, some philosopher or some neurological study. I always ask them to say, okay, what does this tell you about your own lived experience? What is this? Because the whole purpose of this class and this book, in some ways, is to expand people's vocabulary of their own experience of being. I think this is what books do for us. And hopefully what I'm trying to do with this project is give people some tools so that they can better apprehend, okay, what's going on behind the scenes of this experience of me that I'm having. And occasionally I'll see this, and I'll give you an example of this. And I find this a really useful thing to do. We have a whole week on emotions, and we talk about sort of the neuroscience of emotions and around the auspices of what makes a happy life. And I tell them, you know, a lot of the things that we think provide happiness, which we equate happiness with pleasure, and pleasure is simply another kind of emotion. But pleasure doesn't necessarily equal a good life. And there are a lot of reasons for this. If you look at the biology of pleasure, it's meant to be short-lived. It's meant to diminish over time. Pain, on the other hand, is meant to stick around. It's there to inform us when something's going wrong. So, you know, nobody really experiences chronic pleasure. So I ask them to go out and I say, listen, what I want you to do for your assignment this weekend is go out, do something that gives you a lot of pleasure, and then go out and do something that makes you satisfied. And compare those two experiences. Because there's a very different kind of neurochemistry between those two different experiences. Pleasure typically centers around dopamine and some of those neurotransmitters. Satisfaction typically comes from serotonin or maybe oxytocin. And what they end up finding is that like their pleasurable experiences tend to be very solitary and somewhat solipsistic. They're just very, you know, about themselves. Whereas their satisfactions, the ones that last a longer time, they're either, as we were saying earlier, exercising a competency when they're going out and kind of pushing a skill relative to a challenge level, or they're connecting with someone else. And those, I think, are two crucial aspects. And Scott, I think this goes back to your question earlier about no single self. Part of the thing is we don't exist in isolation. Ourselves are social phenomena. It goes down to our cellular level. You know, our cells are comprised of two different species. Within each of our cells are mitochondria, and they have a totally different DNA than the one that programs for you and I. We are actually an amalgamation of species coming together. You know, you can think about being a multicellular being is really an amalgamation of creatures coming together. And we humans who are so culturally embedded and dependent upon language for understanding the world, you know, that's a level of sociability that's baked into us. And then, of course, there's just our connection with other people. We're not born in a way that's like meant to be isolated. If you put anyone away by themselves for a while, they begin to suffer immediately. You know, loneliness is a very strong evolutionary force, and it's basically telling us, get back to the group, you fool, before something eats you. You know, it's there designed to be very powerful. So a big part of knowing ourselves is figuring out how we should relate to others. And that's why all of these things get very, very complicated, because other people can be a pain.
Also, they can be a pain if we let them be a pain, right?
Right, right.
In the table of, or the contents, table of contents, there's so many interesting ones, and I wonder where different chapters go and what they explore. But one jumps out at me, archetypes. That signals to me, oh, there are these different types of self that are archetypes. But can you explore what that chapter is about so our listeners can get more of a sense of your book?
Sure. So this is a chapter that's actually on Jung, on Carl Jung. Yeah. But it's part of a larger section of the book talking about the ego. And so I describe these various layers of self processes. There's a cellular self, there's an animal self, there's a linguistic self. But then within that is this egoistic self. And the egoistic self are all of these processes that we use to negotiate with other people, to make our way through the social world. It's the defender of our rights and entitlements. It's the protector that we're not going to say something terrible that will get us in trouble later on. It's all of these things. It's our sense of status and position in the group. Now, the challenging thing about an ego is that we all kind of recognize ego as such, and we have a sense of that. But the ego does not lend itself to scientific inquiry very easily. We don't really know where in the brain it is. There's not even a consensus about what the ego is or what its constituent parts are. So how do we know this ego? Well, we know it through stories. And if you think about, like, for example, this started with Freud and it continues through Jung, what the ego is about and the way we underapprehend our own egos is through stories. This is what therapy is all about. I'm going in and, you know, telling my therapist stories, and my therapist is helping me reinterpret these stories relative to the ones that I'm doing. That chapter, for example, is on Carl Jung, who is not a very scientific thinker. In fact, he's a very mystical thinker, but he has this very interesting way of interpreting one's stories. He has this idea of archetypes, that there are these continual themes that appear throughout history that, you know, he assigns some, you know, mystical connotations to, and a lot of people believe in, but that can be very interesting and useful for helping us reinterpret the stories of our lives. Freud, which is the previous chapter, offers a very different kind of scheme for helping us interpret our stories. And so that's a big part of exploring our own self-processes, is figuring out ways to interpret our own stories. And once again, this is something I tell my students. I say, listen, the big challenge for you is to try to figure out, are the stories that you're living by stories that you wrote for yourself or stories that someone else wrote for you? And that's a big part of establishing our own autonomy, is coming to terms and figuring out, well, all these expectations that I was living under, maybe this was somebody else's story that was imparted to me. This is not the story I'm writing for myself. And I think that's one of the really, really big challenges in knowing ourselves, is figuring out these stories.
Well, speaking of stories, your new book, How to Know Yourself, The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are, is absolutely fascinating. I love how you blend storytelling and philosophy and just practical insights. I encourage our listeners to pick up your book. And I can't thank you enough for the time that you spent with us here today on Cool Science Radio. Professor Eric Oliver, thanks for being our guest today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. This was a great conversation. I really appreciated being here.